In the words of A.W. Pink, across the varied scenes depicted by prophecy, there falls the shadow of a figure at once commanding and ominous. Under many different names, like the aliases of a criminal, his character and movements are set before us. He is the little horn of Daniel chapter 7. He is a king, insolent and skilled in intrigue, as Daniel chapter 8 records. He is the one who makes desolate. He is the king who does as he pleases. He is the lawless one. He is the rider on a white horse of Revelation chapter 6. He is the beast out of the sea in Revelation chapter 13. He is the devil's advocate and the devil's answer to a desperate and divided world. And he's the focus of our text today. We meet him in Daniel chapter 11. So if you will turn to Daniel chapter 11. 21 days ago, an angelic messenger received a message to deliver to Daniel. But for 21 days, he was opposed. He was delayed by demonic warfare. When he was finally able to deliver the message, we discovered that the subject of this message relates to the future of Daniel's people, Israel, and Daniel's holy city, Jerusalem. We also discovered that the timing of this message spans from the reign of the Persian Empire all the way to the millennial kingdom. And last week we covered the first half of this message. It mainly focused on the conflict that would persist between two dynasties that border Israel following the fall of Alexander the Great. So one, we had the Seleucid kingdom positioned in the north, north of Israel. It's Syria, it's Mesopotamia. And then we had the Ptolemaic kingdom. This is Egypt. This is south of Israel. And we ended our time tracking the exploits of a leader of the Seleucid kingdom, the kingdom of the north, known as Antiochus IV. Pick up the story then today in Daniel chapter 11, verse 36. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods. And he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. The first question that we need to answer when coming to this text is the question of timing. When do the events of this verse take place? If we were to follow this vision to its conclusion in chapter 12, verse 2, we would see that it extends all the way to the resurrection of the dead with no foreseeable divisions between this point and that point. And since that's not happened yet, I think it's safe to assume that at some point in verse 36 to chapter 12, verse 2, we move beyond our present age, beyond history, and find ourselves somewhere in the realm of the future. So the question is, when does the text do that? And I think it happens in the very beginning of this verse. Notice the previous verse, verse 35. The angel speaks of the end time. He's speaking of this Maccabean revolt, this Jewish revolt that is rebelling against Antiochus IV, the Seleucid king of the north. He is persecuting the Jewish people. He is persecuting the Jewish God. He is forbidding the observance of their religion. He's asking them to do things that are forbidden. And they are rebelling against him. And we're told that some of those who have insight, they will fall, these people, in order to refine and purge them, Israel, pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So he speaks of the end time and the appointed time. And then when we come to verse 36, we have this time marker. Then. When? Well, at the appointed time. The end time. He is moving from this situation going on with Antiochus and these Jewish rebels to the end time. Let me go ahead and tell you about that. So we've skipped from about 100 years before Jesus was born all the way to the tribulation period, the last days, the end times. And remember, from Daniel's standpoint, this entire vision is future, okay? This entire vision given by the angel is about tomorrow. But we're standing in a different place in history than Daniel. We have a different vantage point. From our perspective, verse 2 through 35, they're past. That was yesterday. Today, in the church age, we're looking for Christ to come. We're looking for the rapture, our catching up to Him. And then after that, if we're to understand the way that prophecies have unfolded from the book of Daniel, the next event on God's prophetic calendar will be a covenant made between a figure we know as the Antichrist and the nation of Israel. It will be a peace agreement. That is the next event. We came across that in Daniel 9, verse 27, when we were covering the 70 weeks of Daniel. What we have in our text today, verse 36 and following, is going to happen sometime after that period. Sometime following this covenant made between the Antichrist and Israel. So for us, verse 2 through 35 of chapter 11, think of that as yesterday. Today, we're here, we're looking for Christ. Tomorrow, the Antichrist will appear. After we're raptured, tomorrow the Antichrist is coming and he will make a covenant with Israel. And then verse 36 and following, that's the day after tomorrow. So our time in the text today, we're looking at the day after tomorrow. What takes place the day after tomorrow? Another indicator we can find in this text that we've moved into the future is that, look, up until this point, as we discovered last time, God has been very specific about how history is going to unfold. And we could look in history and track each of these little details as they happened. It was very easy to follow the events because there is just incredible historical accuracy. But when we move to verse 36 and following, well, the historical accuracy seems to wane. We can't find any events that directly correspond to this in our known history. I mean, in verse 36, the king mentioned here, he prospers until the indignation is completed. Well, last week we were looking at these northern kings, and remember, they ran into a problem, and that problem's name was Rome. Antiochus did not prosper until the indignation was completed. Eventually, he ran into the empire of Rome, and he became a vassal of Rome. And that's been their situation ever since, until Rome just conquers everything. Okay? So these kings are not doing as they please. Beyond that, we notice that the king mentioned in verse 36, he has no regard for the gods of his fathers. He magnifies himself above them all. But if we were to look at the individuals we know in history, particularly this last king, Antiochus IV, that's simply not true. Because we have records from multiple ancient historians that say Antiochus, the way that he honored the gods of his fathers, actually surpassed all of his predecessors. He said, "I'll see you and I'll raise it." And he actually wanted the Jewish people to worship the Greek gods. So that's just simply not the case. Furthermore, we're going to come across some wars and some events that just never happened. They haven't happened yet. The reason we cannot track these events in history anymore is because we've moved from history to future events. These are what you and I can expect to happen in the future. We won't be here, but the Lord's seen fit to fill us in on what will take place. Now, the next thing we want to determine then is, who is the king mentioned in this verse? Who is this character that strolled onto the scene? For the last 30 verses, you might remember we've been tracking those kings of the north, the kings of the south, designated as such by their relationship on the map to Israel. You know, we're looking at a compass, the ones that are above Israel, kings of the north. Below Israel, kings of the south. But this king is simply referred to as the king. This is the first time in this chapter that we have someone who's just simply designated by a definite article. He's not the king of the north. He's not the king of the south. He's the king. And beyond that, look at verse 40. This individual is actually going to be attacked by the king of the south and by the king of the north. The king of the south will collide with him, the king, and the king of the north will storm against him, the king with chariots. So whoever this individual is, he's actually being attacked from the people who reside above Israel and below Israel. And if we were to continue on in this chapter, we would learn in verse 44 that this king also has problems coming from the east. He's got problems in the north. He's got problems in the south. He's got problems in the east. Well, where does that leave him? There's only one point on the compass left. He comes from the west. The king we're talking about in this text is the king of the west. Do we know of any empires mentioned in the book of Daniel that arise west of Israel? Remember, there are four empires we're tracking in this story before Christ comes. We had Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. Rome, off to the west of Israel. And when we think of Rome, we're thinking of the beast of Daniel chapter 7. Okay, so we had these various kingdoms depicted as animals. So Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom is that lion. Then we have the bear, Medo-Persia. Then we have this four-headed leopard. This is Greece. And then we have the beast, this monstrous image of something with iron teeth that just destroys them all. And I ask, who's supposed to be the king of this Roman Empire? Who is the leader of the beast? Do you remember? Turn just briefly to Daniel chapter 7. We'll read this together. Daniel chapter 7, and let's just start in verse 23. This is the angel's interpretation of the vision of the four beasts. Daniel 7, verse 23. The angel said, "The fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. As for the ten horns," which were on this beast, "out of this kingdom ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them." He is the little horn. "He will be different from the previous ones and will subdue three kings. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. And he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time." They have a leader. It's the devil's advocate. It's this antichrist figure that arises from this confederation of ten kings that will be ultimately leading this future Roman Empire. It is a restored Roman Empire. It is that kingdom from the west that we are expecting to arise. Now look back at chapter 11. Verse 37 and verse 39 is going to give us some insight in regards to the character of this individual, this king that will arise from the west. Verse 37. "He will show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. But instead, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god whom his fathers did not know. He will honor him with gold and silver, costly stones and treasures. He will take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. He will give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and he will cause them to rule over the many, and will parcel out land for a price." When I look at this individual, the first thing that we notice, he's clearly a blasphemous individual. Uniquely blasphemous. He doesn't just refuse to acknowledge God. He magnifies himself in a unique way over God and as God. Now, whether someone believes in a God or gods or no God at all, usually that's influenced by the people that they hang around and the people that they grow up around. If you spend a lot of time in the university or in the sciences, you probably end up an atheist because the people that influence you and the people that you respect, that's their position. If you're born over in India, you might be Hindu. You know, usually the people around you have a strong influence on your belief system. Not so with this individual. Not with this one. He does not regard tradition. He does not regard his father's belief system. Instead, he magnifies himself. He has his own ideas about how this thing is going to work out. And he magnifies himself and worships a God of military might. In the words of one, the world will go delirious with delight at his manifestation. He will be the seeming answer to all of its needs. He will be filled with all the fullness of Satan, handsome and with a charming, rakish, devil-may-care personality, a genius, superbly at home in all the sciences, charming, with discipline, brave as a lion, and with an air of mystery about him to tease the imagination or to chill the blood as occasion may serve. He's brilliant, a master conversationalist, in a score of languages, a soul-captivating orator. He will be the idol of all mankind. He is a man like we've never seen, with the ability to captivate an audience like we've never seen. And I ask, and what does this mean? He has no regard for the desire of women. Will he be a homosexual? Since he is the Antichrist, is he even Antichrist and anti-God in his sexual preference? Does it mean that he simply has no interest in women? You know, he's basically immune to our current sexual scandals that are taking down every other leader and personality in our country. Is that what it is? Is he so consumed with his militaristic campaigns that he has no time to devote to normal relationships? Is that what it means? Look at the preceding context in verse 37. The gods of his fathers. He has no regard for the gods of his fathers. And then the following context. Look at the end of verse 37. He'll show no regard for any other god. He's going to magnify himself above them all. Gods are the subject matter in this verse. And if you were to go a verse up, it'd be gods. Still talking about gods. And if you go to the following verses, we're still talking about gods. So I ask the question, is the author making a statement about his lack of concern for sexuality here? In this dialogue where the author is talking about gods and his thought about gods and the way he's going to magnify himself as God, did he decide to just slip in some random off-the-cuff comment, oh, by the way, he's homosexual? Not likely. So what is he talking about then? What does the desire of women refer to in the biblical story? That's right. I will greatly increase your sorrow and your conception. In sorrow you will bring forth sons, yet your desire will be for your man, and he will rule over you. And we've talked about that verse. That's Genesis 3:16. It's actually part of what we know as the proto-evangelium. We think of Genesis 3:15 when we get the idea of the seed of the woman. I'll put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. And God is speaking to the serpent here, so I know that there's going to be one coming from the serpent and one coming from the woman, and they're at odds with one another. And this one will crush that one's head. But then the next verse, God's still talking. And this time he's talking to the woman. Not in a curse. He's not saying, because you followed this serpent, you're going to have pain in childbirth. You're going to suffer. He's not saying, you're going to want to usurp the authority of your husband at home. I'm not talking about that at all. He said, you're going to want this one to come who's going to judge this serpent because he is your enemy. You're going to desire him, and the Lord is going to multiply her conception. She actually has twins in the next chapter, right? Most likely twins. She has two children with one conception. She has Cain. She has Abel. And how does that turn out? Do they get along? They have enmity. And she has sorrow, doesn't she? Because one kills the other, so he's gone. And then Cain is exiled, so he's gone. And her sorrow continues. And we watch this through the women in the story, starting in Genesis What are they concerned with? Every time they open their mouth, they're only concerned with one thing. Seed. They want to have kids. Well, you come to the story of Jacob, and he has Rachel and Leah, and they're having a fit to have children. Is the desire for seed, but not just any seed, the desire of women, biblically speaking, we're talking about the desire to bear Messiah, the Christ, the one who will come to solve our problem. But the Antichrist, does he care? No. He has no regard for the Christ, the desire of women. He has no regard for any other god other than himself. He magnifies himself in a new god, a god of fortresses. And he enlists the help of a foreign god. Most likely this is Satan. This is the devil. He is the devil's advocate. He is serving his purposes on this earth during this time. Pick it up in verse 40. We're told, at the end time, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him with chariots, with horsemen, and with many ships, and he will enter into countries, overflow them, and pass through. So the kings north and south of Israel, likely we're talking about Egypt in the south. In the north, this is Mesopotamia's area. So we're looking at Mesopotamia, Syria, these Arabic countries surrounding Israel. They attack the Antichrist. What's interesting here, though, is we're not really told anything about the battle. And his victory is just assumed because apparently he enters countries and overflows them and passes through. So he fights a two-front war somehow and wins and overflows. He passes through. I said that's a strange way of talking about a victory. But we may be able to gather some information as to why it's discussed in this way through a parallel account. Now, if you have your prophets chart that I gave you, if you look to try to find Ezekiel, you'll observe that Ezekiel is an exilic prophet, like Daniel, which means that the two of them are both writing during the same time period, while Israel is in captivity. And with that in mind, it shouldn't surprise us if they write about the same subjects occasionally. They're in the same time period, suffering the same kinds of persecution, receiving revelation from God, and at times writing about the same subject. Turn to Ezekiel chapter 38. I believe this to be a parallel account. This is what's known as the Battle of Gog and Magog. This Ezekiel is the book right before Daniel in your Bible, so just turn left just a little bit. Go to Ezekiel chapter 38. In the 36th chapter of Ezekiel, the author covers the return of Israel to the land, the future return of the nation to the land. In chapter 37, the author covers that familiar passage about the dry bones. So not only will Israel return to the land, they will return to the land in unbelief, like they have today. They'll become a nation again in the land, but they will not have repented. They will not have faith in Jesus as the Messiah. When we come to chapters 40 through 48, well, that's those kind of strange and confusing chapters that deal with this millennial temple. It's this rebuilt temple unlike any that we ever have recorded in history. But you know what happens right in between chapters 37 that talks about Israel's return in unbelief? In chapters 40 through 48, this millennial kingdom temple. Well, we have a crazy battle. The battle of Gog and Magog. Sandwiched right in between there that kind of explains what's going to start leading Israel towards repentance and faith and belief in the Messiah. Pick it up. Look at chapter 38, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to me, Ezekiel, saying, Son of man, set your face towards Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal, and prophesy against him, and say, Thus says the Lord God, Behold, I am against you, O Gog, prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. I will turn you about and put hooks into your jaws, and I will bring you out, and all your army, horses and horsemen, all of them, splendidly attired, a great company with buckler and shield, all of them wielding swords. Persia, Ethiopia, and Put with them, all of them with shield and helmet. Gomer with all his troops. Beth Togarma from the remote parts of the north with all his troops. Many peoples with you. Here we're introduced to the usual suspects. Persia, mentioned here, is modern-day Iran. Put is Libya. Libya is also actually mentioned in Daniel chapter 11. Ethiopia is there, also mentioned in Daniel chapter 11. Beth Togarma is Syria. Magog, Meshech, Tubal, Gomer. These are areas in modern-day Turkey, in Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. All Muslim countries, all Arab countries surrounding Israel in the Middle East. Countries north and south of Israel. And the chief one here, the question when we're looking at Rosh, one question we have is Rosh a transliteration? Is it a place? Because in Hebrew it could mean chief. So we could be talking about Gog, the chief prince of Turkey in these areas. Or we could be talking about a location. If it's a location, then we're talking about Russia. So we have a situation where either a solely Muslim confederacy one day attempts to carry out the threats that they make on a daily basis, or we have a situation where a Muslim confederacy lists the aid of Russia to carry out the threats that they make on a daily basis. You know, we see a lot of saber rattling in the news. One day they're going to make good on the threats that they make against Israel. They're going to come. They're going to attack. Notice it, verse 18. On that day when Gog comes against the land of Israel. They're attacking Israel. In Daniel chapter 11, the kingdoms of the north and the kings of the south, they attack the Antichrist. Does that mean that these are different battles? Look at Ezekiel 38, verse 8. After many days, speaking to Gog, you will be summoned. In the latter years, you will come into the land that is restored from the sword, whose inhabitants have been gathered from many nations to the mountains of Israel, which had been a continual waste. But its people were brought out from the nations, and they are living securely, all of them. Look at verse 14. Prophesy, son of man, and say to Gog, thus says the Lord God, on that day when my people Israel are living securely, will you not know it? You will come from your place out of the remote parts of the north, you and many peoples with you, all of them riding on horses, a great assembly and a mighty army, and you will come up against my people Israel like a cloud to cover the land. It shall come about in the last days that I will bring you against my land so that the nations may know me when I am sanctified through you before their eyes, O God. So Gog and Magog, this battle occurs in the latter years, usually referencing the period of the end, this tribulation period leading up to Christ's return. Israel has been regathered to the land. They're living securely. Verse 11 actually says they're living in with unwalled villages. Translation, there is peace in the Middle East. Is there any period in the future before Jesus returns where Israel will have this kind of security in the land? Will they ever have the kind of security where they could say, rebuild the temple? The answer is yes. Yes. During that first 3.5 years of the tribulation, after the Antichrist makes a covenant, Daniel 9:27, he is promising them peace. He is promising them protection. They can live securely. They're still under Gentile dominion. But this ruler of this fourth world empire, Rome, says, I'll protect you. And according to Ezekiel 38, if we were to follow this passage, these armies are actually destroyed by an act of God. There is earthquakes and hailfire and torrential rain and a plague on the people, and the men actually start fighting each other. And these massive armies from this Middle Eastern confederacy that just turns itself against Israel is supernaturally wiped out, obliterated, before they ever succeed in their endeavor. In fact, listen to this. This is verse 12 of chapter 39. The devastation is actually going to be so terrific that for 7 months, the house of Israel will be burying the bodies to cleanse the land. There are so many people that make up this army that it will take them half of a year just to bury the bodies. Even more incredible, you look at verse 9, the ones who inhabit the cities of Israel, they're going to go out and they're going to make fires with the weapons that these people were using. Out of the shields, the bucklers, they're going to make fires, and for 7 years, they're going to use them to make fires. They're not going to take wood from the field. They're not going to have to gather firewood. They're just going to go loot this stuff, and they're going to use it for fuel for 7 years. There's an incredible destruction. This army is wiped out. And when the Antichrist arrives for war, there's nobody there. They're gone. Bodies. That's it. So with this in mind, when I'm looking at this, I'm looking at this incredible destruction sometime in the first half of the tribulation before the Antichrist breaks his covenant with Israel. When they are living in peace because of his protection, these nations are going to turn on them. They're going to attack Israel, be supernaturally destroyed. And I think, you know, this could take place very early on. It doesn't have to be more than a day after this covenant is made. You may recall, in May 14th in 1948, when Israel declared their dependence, the very next day, May 15th, 1948, the Israel-Arab War started. If you look it up, this is when Egypt and Jordan and Syria and Iraq, they all attack. They just surround Israel and try to wipe them out. The day after they declare their independence. Interestingly enough, Jordan declared on May 2nd that they would not attack Israel. They would accept it. They openly agree that we'll be at peace with them. And then they immediately break their agreement the very next day. It may be these nations do the same thing. I know for 7 years they're going to be burning this stuff. Well, it's a 7-year tribulation. That's possible. But that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. It's just sometime in this first 3.5-year period. Go ahead and turn back to Daniel chapter 11. What we'll find is the Antichrist comes. He arrives for war. The armies have been wiped out, which is why Daniel 11 said that he will overthrow. He will pass through. You see, the great destruction has created a huge power vacuum in the Middle East. All the national powers are wiped. They don't have a military anymore. So he can just walk in and take over the joint. It's his now. He's the only one with an army. So he takes it. He begins to take control and fill this power vacuum. Look at verse 41. He will also enter the beautiful land, and many will fall. But these will be rescued out of his hand: Edom, Moab, and the foremost sons of Ammon. And then he will stretch out his hand against other countries, and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he will gain control over the hidden treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt. And Libyans and Ethiopians will follow at his heels. The Antichrist is like a guest that got invited and then decided, well, this place is kind of nice and I don't want to leave. He comes, there's no one there to fend him off. So he begins just taking ownership of the country surrounding Israel. And hey, he's already in Israel. Why not take Israel too? This is actually kind of a fact of history. If you do a little looking, Rome does this. There's an early period on before Christ comes. The reason that Rome is ruling is because there was a dispute over the high priesthood. And one of the priests asked Rome to come help them. He says, look, I'm the one who should be the high priest here. You guys said I could be because they're vassals at the time. He said, come help me. This guy has deposed me. Rome comes to help him, and then they just decide, well, we're going to stay now. This place is ours. We own it. We kind of did that with Hawaii. Did you know that? Yeah. We had some people that led somewhat of a coup d'etat. They had some investment in the sugar plantation and decided to try to take Hawaii without, I guess it was Grover Cleveland at the time, without his approval. And then the United States, even though that was wrong, and they decided, well, I think we'll keep Hawaii. And we incorporated it into our United States. Look, it's a very interesting story. Here we have the Antichrist. And I think that this probably marks, it says that he enters the beautiful land and many will fall. I think the many will fall. Your text might say countries, but if it does, it's probably in italics because that is not in the text. And it might be inferring that because it talks about Edom and Moab. It talks about other countries in 42. But I don't think that's what it's talking about here. I think he's starting to wipe out Israel in this. I think this is the midpoint. I think this is when he breaks his treaty with Israel. He comes to the beautiful land, to Jerusalem. He goes to the temple. Guess what? These massive armies have been supernaturally destroyed in such a way that it's obvious to everyone that happened. Well, who do you think did that? Maybe it was the Antichrist. Maybe he's responsible. And if he is he not the God who should be worshipped? And if you don't, maybe he'll do that to you. So I think this is the point where he enters into the temple, declares himself to be God, demands worship. Israel sees the abomination of desolation, they refuse, and he starts wiping them out. But notice, from this point, he goes to Egypt. And I ask, in the connection between 41 and 42, how is it that Edom and Moab and Ammon, so this is Esau's descendants, this is Lot's two descendants, somehow they escape from the Antichrist's attack. And the reason I think that is, it could be two possible reasons. One, Israel has to flee. And the question is, where on earth do they go to escape the Antichrist? We're told in Revelation chapter 12, Israel is spoken of as the woman, and she's given two wings to flee into the wilderness. This is after Satan and Michael have a showdown in heaven. Satan's cast out of heaven. His angels are cast out. They're still hanging out there now. It's not a problem. They're in the heavenly places. That's why in Ephesians, Paul will say that Christ came and that basically the salvation of believers is demonstrating things to the wicked powers who are our enemies in the heavenly places. They're in the spiritual realm. Satan's still alive and well, and he still has access to heaven. But in Revelation 12, during this period of time, he's cast out. He tries to take over the joint. This is the right time. He fails. And he knows his time is short, and he tries to attack Israel. So she's given the ability to flee into the wilderness, the text says in Revelation 12. I think this is what it's talking about. They're going to Edom, they're going to Moab, very possible. So the question is, why doesn't the Antichrist just pursue? Well, it's possible that God is protecting them. He knows. He knows he didn't cause the destruction, even if he claims it. Or, probably even more likely, we notice that his route, he's going to Egypt. Egypt is southwest, really. South, but a little west of Israel. If you were to look on the compass, Edom, Moab, and Ammon, that's east. So he's kind of going in a different direction. He's got other business to handle, and he's finishing off the king of the south that came up against Israel. He says, he's wiped out the north, now we have business. So he goes to take over Egypt. We find him there. Libyans and Ethiopians are at his heels. It's essentially like they're carrying a bridal train. Now they've capitulated. They're following the Antichrist. They're on his team. And like the text said, look, he's parceling out land and he's giving rule and authority to the people who submit to him. He's ruling this world empire. And if you're on his team, then you can participate in his rule. Kind of like we are on Christ's team. In the millennial kingdom, you will participate in the rule of Christ. You're a co-heir, a co-ruler. Antichrist, this counterfeit, does it the same way. So I look at this. I look at the events as they are taking place. I ask the question here, what will be his end? Verse 44. Rumors from the east and the north will disturb him, and he will go forth with great wrath and destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his tents and the tents of the royal pavilion between the seas of the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him." What are the rumors from the east and the north? Well, to determine that, we got to figure out where the east and the north are. Is it east and north from the Antichrist while he's in Egypt? If that's the case, if Egypt is southwest, northeast goes back to Israel. Over there would be in the east of Israel. North, Israel, east would be Edom and Moab, these areas where the Jews went. So if that's the case, then there's possibly a Maccabean-like revolt taking place, and he's going to go back and squash it. Or, if we're still talking about directions relative to Israel, we're talking about the kings of the east. This is Revelation 16. Who are the kings of the east? Listen to this. This is the sixth bowl. Revelation chapter 16. Verse 12. "The sixth angel poured out his bowl on the great river, the Euphrates, and its water dried up, so that the way would be prepared for the kings of the east." The Euphrates River is going to dry up towards the end of the tribulation. And kings east of the Euphrates River, who's east of the Euphrates River? This is Asia. We're thinking about like China. The kings of the east, these Asian kings, are going to be able to come across. They're getting ready for the Battle of Armageddon. So it's possible that that's the kings of the east. And if, as we talked about at the Battle of Gog and Magog, if Rosh is not Russia, well then Russia will be the king of the north. Because the whole Middle Eastern area has just been sealed up by the Antichrist. And these other powers may be saying, look, now's our last chance. We're either going to stop him now or never. So they start assembling for this final battle. One of the two, he sets up his headquarters either way between the two seas, that's between the Mediterranean and the Dead Sea. He sets it up in Jerusalem. This is his new capital. And he prepares for the Battle of Armageddon, where we're told he will come to his end. He will have no help. And of course, we know for that final battle, our Lord returns with the armies from heaven, that he slays him with the breath of his mouth. In fact, he slays the armies. He doesn't even do that to the beast. Listen to this. This is Revelation 19, verse 19. He doesn't slay the Antichrist. "And I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. And the beast was seized," this is the Antichrist, "and with him the false prophet who performed signs in his presence by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the Antichrist, those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire which burns with brimstone. The rest were killed with the sword which came from the mouth of him," this is Jesus, "who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh." So we have these armies assembling, the kings of the east, of the north assembling for Battle of Armageddon. That's further detailed in Revelation 16, just following that. And then Jesus comes back, and then he sets up his kingdom. But first, he deals with the Antichrist. He casts him into the lake of fire. So, what's taking place in Daniel chapter 11 in these verses from 36 to 45? Basic outline. What do we expect in the future? What's the timeline? Today, we're looking for Christ. We're looking for his imminent coming. We're looking for a rapture, our catching up to heaven. We'll return with him in Revelation 19. But for a period in time, you're caught up to Christ. After that, peace in the Middle East. The Antichrist signs a peace treaty, a 7-year covenant, guaranteeing peace for Israel. After that, an Islamic invasion of Israel, the Battle of Gog and Magog. They're not having it. God miraculously destroys the armies. The Antichrist then takes control of the Middle East. He demands worship. He takes control of Israel. He sets up his headquarters in Jerusalem. The Battle of Armageddon follows, and he's cast into the lake of fire. But that's not the end of the story. And Daniel's going to tell us the end in chapter 12, which we'll cover next week.